You're listening to the John C. Scott Political Forum. This podcast is a Bustos Media production on The Voice. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Thank you. Good afternoon. It's Friday. Thank goodness it's Friday. It is the 17th day of May. I have a great show lineup for you today. Don Jorgensen, former chair of the Democratic Party, talks about a war with Iran and the United States, really. And what about dumping illegal immigrants that have been apprehended into Democratic cities all across Florida? What the hell is that all about? We'll talk with Don Jorgensen. Ed Ackerley will be with us. He's an independent candidate for mayor. Here's what I ask you to do about Ed Ackerley. Listen to him. He's taking this job seriously, and you should take him seriously if you're running for mayor of Tucson. He's quite a guy. Ed Ackerley, independent candidate for mayor. Benny White will be with us. He flew Delta Airline passenger jets all over the world, investigated aviation crashes all over the world. He will be commenting on whether the Boeing 737 MAX will ever fly again. There's a well-known psychologist, Julia Sherman. She'll be in my studio at 4 o'clock today, along with Larry Bodine of Blog for Arizona. She has a new book, Beating Depression and Bipolar Disorder Without Drugs. She has a Ph.D. in clinical psychology. She's been certified by the American Board of Examiners in professional psychology. On top of that, she is a American Psychology Association expert, and she's written two scientific articles and two books about the mental illness called bipolar disorder. Her question from me is, do you think the Justice Department of the United States should consider invoking the 25th Amendment that President Donald Trump is unfit to hold the office of President of the United States? The second question, do you think he's mentally ill? Well, we'll hear from Dr. Julia Sherman to answer the question I just asked. And then Jeff Rogers, former chair of the Democratic Party, will be with us. Let's go to Don Jorgensen. He's the former chair of the Democratic Party as well. And Don, welcome to the show. I'm so glad you could join us. Thank you.
Good afternoon, John. How are you?
Very, very busy. Thank you so much. I'm so glad you could join us. A lot going on with Donald Trump. There's no question. The war drums beating in the Gulf, and there's all kinds of apprehension about what is the foreign policy of the United States towards Iran, and how close are we to an absolute armed conflict? What do you think?
Well, a couple of good questions there. What's the America's foreign policy in general? The short answer is there is none. We know the posture toward Iran based on Trump's actions that he's taken from the beginning, and that is to provoke either an internal regime change or to provoke war. And that, of course, started with reneging on the Iran nuclear deal, which I think started all of this unraveling and increasing tensions. Add to that the increased sanctions against Iran, and followed up just a couple of weeks ago by declaring the guard there a terrorist organization. And so it's the U.S. that has been ramping up those pressures. Not that Iran, is by any means, a stellar of diplomacy or a stellar of human rights or even a nation that deserves to be given any benefit of the doubt or any credit. They obviously are also engaged in anti-democratic action. They're engaged in the wars in Yemen. So it's a place that's ripe for tensions, and instead of seeking to reduce them, Donald Trump has sought to increase those tensions by speeding the carrier group into the Gulf and all of that. What's interesting now is he is the one who has stepped back and said he doesn't want war and is seeming to blame that on his national security advisor, John Bolton. So it's a bit of a holding pattern with regard to Trump and the administration, but there is still no clear sense of what that foreign policy goal or direction will be, which leaves everyone, and by everyone we mean countries in the Middle East and countries part of NATO, on edge.
We're talking with Don Jorgensen, former chair of the Democratic Party. Don, Florida officials raising alarm, pressing for details about a purported intention of the Trump administration to send literally thousands of immigrants a week into two heavily Democratic counties of South Florida. Customs and Border Protection has not publicly disclosed the plans, but a partial picture of the new approach to managing a record influx of immigrants at the southern border came into view Thursday based upon accounts of the local leaders in Broward and Palm Beach counties. Even allies of the president were confused. The state's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis joined federal lawmakers in Florida, Republicans and Democrats alike, questioning the apparent effort to force the immigration and asylum burden onto two local jurisdictions that are Democrats, taking poor immigrants who have suffered so much just to get to where they are and using them as pawns to punish Democrats in Florida. What the hell? What the hell? That's my question.
This is, again, Donald Trump, I think, at his most cynical, his most childish, and certainly his most cruel. And he has the Customs and Border Protection and Border Security just going along with it. Yeah, they have to. But even he said, in talking about sending these folks to sanctuary cities a few months ago, Donald Trump himself said it was a sick idea. And here he is throwing it out again, joking about, if he's joking, creating a humanitarian crisis. And we know it's all about playing to his base. It's all about re-election in 2020. It's all about feeding his own ego in that way. But you're right. It's a sick idea. As we said, it's cruel, even suggesting sending these folks, displacing them even further, farther away from perhaps where they are seeking to go, but without food, without housing, without security or protection, into these two counties, which incidentally are Broward County and Palm Beach County on the southeast of Florida coast, just above Miami. What's also interesting about this is Palm Beach County is the home of a little place called Mar-a-Lago. You could suggest that if Democrats wanted to be equally childish, which usually not, and they tend to be the adults when you're dealing with situations like this, you could perhaps put all these migrants on a bus and send them over and camp out across from Mar-a-Lago, or send them up to Tallahassee and let the Republican governor of Florida, DeSantis, and Marco Rubio deal with it, because it's the president from their own party seeking to dump these people in their state.
The blatant politics of sending them to the two most Democratic counties in the state of Florida is ridiculous. That's what Gary Farmer, who is a Democratic state senator representing part of Broward County, told Politico. He said, you just can't make this stuff up. Each of the counties has a sizable Hispanic population, though I don't think as large as Miami-Dade, which is the state's most populous county. Miami-Dade is also a center of the state's Republican-aligned Cuban voting bloc, which delivered for Trump in 2016. But to take literally thousands of immigrants and throw them into those two counties because they're Democrat as some sort of punishment is just, it's beyond the pale. I mean, it's just so egregious, you just can't make this up. Well, I tell you, you give Donald Trump a blonde wig and a dragon and we're all dead, I think, pretty much, the way it seems to be going.
You may be talking to one of your guests who actually has not watched Game of Thrones.
Well, you know what I'm talking about. Anyway.
But you're right. I mean, this is Trump at his most cynical, at his most cruel, without any sense of decency. The irony is, talking about Florida, in a sense, is like Arizona, one of the states who is quite used to dealing with issues with immigrants and treating them humanely. But it's just another failure of this administration, both with regard to immigration policy, domestic policy, and a failure of human decency. And there's no other way to put it.
You know, the Trump administration, we talked about this in the very beginning of our conversation, Don Jorgensen, is now sending top national security officials to brief Congress on the escalating tensions with Iran. And they're agreeing to multiple meetings intended to head off a growing frustration with the president and his senior advisors. You got Daniel Coates, the director of national intelligence, General Paul Nicholson, who heads the National Security Agency. The U.S. Cyber Command met privately yesterday with a gang of eight, including top Republicans and Democrats in the Senate and the House, as heads of each of the chamber's intelligence committees. The sessions followed by separate briefings on all members of the House and Senate, and even those that attended these meetings came out shaking their head. They simply don't know what this policy is toward Iran, but they do know it is potentially dangerous and disastrous. So that's where we are.
We are. In addition, there are two other issues of concern. One is the belief that this may be Trump, in one sense, doing Saudi Arabia's bidding. They are the ones who are dealing in Yemen, fighting against the Iran-backed insurgents there. And we know that Trump tends to do favors for his friends and or to those to whom he owes money. That's a concern. The other concern is this lack of foreign policy, this approach that Donald Trump has had to embrace his enemies and reject our friends and allies has created problems within NATO. And so we have folks within NATO who are not that eager to get involved or to back up the United States and Donald Trump in this case. And so you have problems on multiple levels there here, because now we have an administration and the United States with little to no credibility when it comes to making declarations such as Donald Trump has made as to how severe the problem might be. And even when it is severe, we may have a president now who has cried wolf too often, and that could be a problem. The other problem is making demands on Iran that are just unreasonable in order to avoid war. So we have a foreign policy that's in complete chaos, an administration that's arguing among themselves, a president who is more concerned with his ego than with protecting and defending the United States and our friends and allies and military men and women overseas. And it's hard to see where this is going to go unless we have another country, unless we have NATO step in and provide some additional restraint or common sense, because it's certainly not coming out of the White House right now.
Final question for you, John Jorgensen. Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York City, in the race for president. All God's children want to be president, so the more the merrier. What the heck? What about the latest entry, Don?
Well, I think he brings it up to 23. What's interesting is there were some men and women on the street interviews in New York when they asked what they thought of Bill de Blasio running for president, and honestly, half of them thought it was a joke. The other half just shook their head. However, this is a man who's coming from the progressive side of the Democratic Party, and that's where he's going to make his stand. He has a mixed record, frankly, as mayor of New York City. He has done a lot in dealing with providing health care, in dealing with some economic issues there, and New York's doing better economically. He's got an interesting background. He was actually Hillary Clinton's campaign manager for her Senate race in 2000 when she won and managed that well. So he's an interesting character. Another interesting factor is he has presided over an administration, even though it's a mayoral administration, that covered more residents than the three governors who are also in the race, Inslee of Washington, and the governors of both Colorado and Montana, Hickenlooper and Bullock, have had smaller constituencies than Bill de Blasio. He's the third mayor to get in the race, and so we have quite an interesting mix. However, at this stage, I think anyone who comes in is really going to benefit the front runners. Joe Biden, I'm not sure so much about Bernie Sanders. It may hurt Sanders a little bit because de Blasio may pull a little bit from the progressive side. But what you have is someone who is splitting those primary voters even further. Although it'll certainly make for some very crowded debate stages next month when the Democratic primary debates begin.
John Jorgensen, thanks so much for being with us. Always great to hear from you. We'll talk next week. I'm glad you're back home and good to have you on our show. Thank you so very much.
Have a good weekend, John.
Thank you. Will indeed. Thank you. Former chair of the Democratic Party, Don Jorgensen, in the John C. Scott Show. Ed Ackerley, independent candidate for mayor. My guest live in studio next, right after these messages. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the John C. Scott Political Forum. I've been doing this a long time, about 50 years in this business of journalism and talk shows, 31 years as a talk show host. I've interviewed literally hundreds and hundreds of politicians. Very few have ever done their homework. Only about half that I've interviewed have any idea in the world why they're in a race for the political office they seek. But the exception is Ed Ackerley. Not only has he done his homework, he understands the responsibility of the job that he wants to hold and wants you to give him in the election of 2019. Ed Ackerley is an ad agency owner and proprietor of one of the great ad agencies in the history of Tucson, longtime Tucsonan, and an independent candidate for mayor. Ed, welcome to the show. Glad you could be here. Thanks.
Thank you, John.
You know, it seems to me you've really, the homework I talked about you doing is you've been to just about every department head the city has, so you understand what the city does. And I will tell you, I've talked to city council people that don't know what the city does, and they've been on the damn council for years. I mean, it seems absurd, but it's true.
I think that's an interesting point because even in some of the informational forums that we've been in, you know, we're talking about issues, or I'm not talking about them, but issues are being brought up that are kind of off the map of what municipal government really is for. And it's, you know, it's pretty limited as what we should be talking about, which is, you know, police and fire, roads and transportation, economic development, parks and lifestyle, a little bit of water, a little bit of recycling and trash. And so it's interesting. And going around all the departments, I've learned a little bit about each of them. Obviously, in an hour and a half, it's not able to learn everything, but it's been a great education for me as to what these departments are, what their goals are, and what their vision is for the future.
And they are the real instruments. I mean, we are a city manager form of government. We have literally an administration that runs the city and kind of a city council and mayor that kind of sets the policy and then ask the administrators to implement it with the advice of those administrators as well as the city manager. It's an unusual structure of government, isn't it?
Yeah, it's unusual, but it's not unheard of. And certainly the way that the structure sets with the manager being in charge of the day-to-day operations, it's important that he has a good staff that's professional and implements the policies of the council and the mayor. And so you know, I have to be honest, I'm a fan of Michael Ortega. I think he's done a good job in the last few years of trying to restructure some of the departments and combine a couple of them and move them in a direction which is more efficient and more reflective of the priorities of the budget. I may just say that I differ a little bit with the direction of the budget, and the council and the mayor are the ones that set the policy for where the budget is going. The manager is the one that's implementing those policies. So,
what gives you some anxiety about the budget?
Well, I just think that we need to do a little bit more. I understand the complexity of the budget, but I think that the police and fire issue is one that I think is really important, and certainly the manager is addressing that, and the police department and the fire department are addressing it in their own way. But I just think generally as a community, we have probably not funded the police and fire to the extent that we should. We you know, there's people say that we're at 1988 levels for police staffing. Well, I had a 90-minute conversation with the police chief last week, and you know, it's not a matter of necessarily. We need some more officers, obviously, especially with the population growth and the demands on the department. But, you know, we also need efficiency within the organization. We need equipment that they can use to mitigate. And one of the biggest problems that the fire and the police have is that so many of their calls now are related to drug abuse and to homelessness and to mental illness. And so the TC3 program, where we're looking at sending other types of professionals out to engage with some of these, I think is a really, really important move for us, because from a budgetary standpoint, we need to be focusing the money on the police officers and the first responders, fire and EMTs, to life-threatening emergencies and not to ones that would dissuade them. We shouldn't be sending a million-dollar vehicle down the street to talk to somebody who's called for the 15th time about a mental illness issue.
You know, when your government makes a mistake or doesn't do what they need to do, it's always revealed in some kind of negative form. I think the numbers of pedestrian traffic deaths in our city reveals a flaw in government. I think that the idea that we may be undermanned when it comes to the traffic control of our community from a policing standpoint. Jim Hanley, who is the husband of Pamela Powers Hanley, who's a member of the House of Representatives from Legislative District 9, has repeatedly said he's so disappointed that the traffic tickets have not been written. He believes the police chief and others have just said that they've got a department of police officers who don't want to write tickets, and there is a lack of literally policing of bad driving that has led to many accidents, has led to speeding and pedestrian deaths, and there's a problem there. Now, I don't know what that problem totally is, but I do know it's a problem, and it can be solved, I think, with more cops on the street, making us more safe on our streets.
I think it's a combination of two things, John. I think it obviously, if we had more personnel on the street, we'd be able to intercept some of those people that are driving a little bit too fast. I know that the chief acknowledges that the speeding problem in Tucson is pretty bad. As a matter of fact, on another show, he made a mention of the possibility of talking about resurrecting the red light cameras. And the reason for that is that at some of these intersections where the red light cameras were and now they're gone, there's even more accidents than before they were installed. But I think in talking with the new director of transportation, I think one of the ways that we can solve this problem is obviously with more police officers, but also with technology. We need to do a better job of making sure that when you go to a stoplight now, you see the blinking yellow arrow, and the research on that has shown that that is helping with people running red lights and people T-boning people as they come flying through the intersection trying to make that light. And so I think part of the issue with pedestrians and so forth is to have a consistency. We don't have consistent turn signals and consistent lighting on all the intersections in the city. We have different ones in different places and different kinds of intersections in different places. And so the transportation director is working to try and mitigate that by trying to coordinate to make sure that all the different major intersections have a similar thing so that when drivers drive in Tucson, they know that they can't beat the yellow to get through and then obviously hit the red light and then T-bone somebody. In terms of pedestrians, I think that this also is an issue with the Complete Streets project that has been approved by council. An emphasis is being made on trying to make way for pedestrians and bicyclists and others to use the street. We have been so car-centric in the last 40 years, say, of building streets that were primarily intended for cars. And in some cases, we didn't even think about transit. And so we've tried to fit the transit system in on streets that were designed for cars. And then now we try and fit a little bit of a lane for bicycles. And so now we have three competing entities trying to be on the same road. And so I think the Complete Streets initiative is an important initiative for our city in that we can perhaps maybe use technology and use design to help us mitigate some of these traffic problems. One pedestrian death is too many, and we've got to figure out a way to make that not happen.
We're talking with Ed Ackerley, who is an independent candidate for mayor. He's the head of his ad agency, Ackerley Advertising. Ed, you talked about you wanted to be the marketing leader of this community as mayor of Tucson. Well, what do you mean by that, and how would you do that, and what role would you play that along with being the mayor of our city?
Well, I think that my analogy that I use is people hop on a plane and go somewhere else. They hop off the plane, they get into an Uber or a taxi or a limousine or a hotel shuttle, and the person driving says, "Hey, where are you from?" And you say, "Well, I'm from Tucson." They say, "Oh, Tucson, yeah, tell me about Tucson." And most of us would probably list about 10 or 12 things of what makes Tucson great. We go to our little event or whatever we're doing out of town, we hop back on the plane, come back to Tucson, and by the time we hit TIA and start heading back to our homes and our watering holes, we start talking about all the terrible things that are happening in Tucson, the roads and the police and the fire, and all, the list is endless of all the things we think are wrong. What I say is that, well, why did you come to Tucson in the first place? And what makes it a reason for a destination for so many people all around the world to come to Tucson? And so my bumper sticker is, "Tucson, it's pretty cool." Hey, we live here for a reason. We've got a great lifestyle, great weather. We've got problems, but we've also got a lot of fantastic things like the university, like the culture, like the food, like the sports. We've got so many wonderful things that are going on in Tucson. So one of my jobs as the mayor would be to be the chief executive marketing officer for the city of Tucson and tell people what is, and tell ourselves. I think we need to tell each other what's great about Tucson. I'm not trying to be glossy-eyed about this. I just think it's a reality. People come from all over the world to visit Tucson every year, and they're doing it for a reason, and I think we need to recognize that we have some pretty cool things going on in Tucson.
When it's 115 degrees in about 6 weeks, how are you going to sell that one is what I want to know. You're going to be the best marketing guy in the whole world.
Kind of a play on words, but it is pretty cool in Tucson. It's cooler here than it is up north anyway, if we can say that.
Well, there's no question. I think people choose Tucson and stay in Tucson just out of choice. You know,
yep.
I had many opportunities to leave. I left a couple times, came back after a very brief exit, and never regretted it at all.
Right.
Raised family here and made a career here only because I love the lifestyle. Right. And most people do. The salaries are terrible and you struggle to make a living. At least most of us do. But it's just a comfortable place to be.
It really is a comfortable place to be. And it's, I think it's got a reputation that I think is pretty good. You know, when you tell people you're from Tucson, they usually say favorable things about it. They don't roll their eyes and say, oh, that's a terrible place to live. They usually say something positive, at least to me. And I've been to Colorado recently, to Minneapolis, and traveling around. And when I hop off the plane and someone asks me where I'm from, I say I'm from Tucson. It's almost universal that they say something positive about what's going on in our community.
If you would change one thing as you take a look at the city council and its mayor and its city manager, what would it be? What would be the first thing that might be something you would change if you are now mayor of Tucson just a few months from now?
Well, I was going to catch you there and say the one thing I would change is who's sitting in the mayor's seat, because when Jonathan leaves, I want to be that guy that's sitting in the chair. I think one of the things, I believe that we've, in the last 10 or so years, we've been kind of drifting to the left. And what I mean by that is that we've been talking about issues that perhaps aren't part of governance of local municipalities should be talking about. For instance, border issues. Although they're important to Tucson, and certainly the city of Tucson is facing an influx of immigrants and passing through for a couple of days and trying to mitigate that problem. I totally get that we're a border city. I'm not underestimating what the power of immigration and illegal immigration and the border situation is. But that's a federal issue. And granted, we're getting immigrants, I don't want to use the word dumped, but put into our city, and we have to figure out a way to help move them through to their destinations. And I think we've done a fairly decent job of that. And of course, the mayor convened a group of staff people and some interested parties to try and see what we could come up with as an alternative to the Benedictine Convent and some other things. But what I mean by this is that we've been focusing on some issues that I think we spent a lot of time on drifting a little bit to the left. And what I want to do, what I would change, is focus on the future and go forward and talk about things like getting police and fire up to the levels that they need to be, making sure that our brand new economic initiatives office with soon to be 5 people in it really can do its work to help Sun Corridor and help the chambers and other folks that are trying to bring new businesses here. But I talked with Barbara Coffey. She's the new director. I talked with her about what can we do to bolster the businesses that are here. We have 8 out of 10 jobs typically come in a state or a city from businesses that are already located in that community. And so we have to do a better job so one thing that I would change is the focus on let's bolster these companies that are here that have employees here. How can we help them? So to answer your question, I would change drifting to the left and change that to moving forward and moving ahead.
Are you comfortable with the job Trio's doing to bring new jobs to Tucson?
I think so. They have there's so much competition in that arena. And like I said, 8 out of 10 jobs come from people that are already located in the city. And we have to be sure that we're going after the right types of job. If we go after the giant Amazon headquarters and spend a lot of time and effort on that, is it realistic that they're going to relocate a huge company like that in Tucson, Arizona, where the airline situation is not the greatest, where it's hard to get in and out of Tucson without having to go to a hub? So they're going to want to be in a city where there's a ton of direct flights. And so we have to get the kinds of businesses that fit well with our culture and with our optics and with even a little bit of mining that we've had for centuries and the things that we do well here in Tucson and go after this. So I would say Trio does a good job. I think we need to have a real focus on companies that match the kinds of things that we have available in Tucson, and not try and go after businesses that don't really match with the type of culture, business culture that we have here in Tucson.
Are you happy with Rio Nuevo and the way it's unfolded in the recent years?
Absolutely. I think they've done a really good job in the last decade to, I'll say 5 years, to kind of change that, turn that thing totally around and come up with some good ideas. I think that the districts, I would like them to include some more districts in their taxing authority so that we could do some more exciting things in some other directions. Stone Avenue is a good example. You know, we had in 2000, we had this great plan. The city and had a huge committee put together to work on Stone Avenue, and we haven't been able to implement anything there because we just haven't had the resources to be able to do the street plan and to bring the infill in. That whole plan, it was a great plan, but we just didn't have the resources for it. So I think Rio Nuevo has done a good job of spending the money and reallocating it to places where it needs to go. And I think the city's been a good partner with them in that.
We still haven't connected the Aviation Barraza Parkway with I-10. I think that we tried to do that for the last 15 years.
Yes.
Still haven't got... Why the hell can't we do that? I don't get it.
Well, I
mean,
think
there was one building and one street and then this and that.
Yeah, eminent domain, of course.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean,
it is pretty interesting to watch them with the new widening on Broadway to drive down the street one day and see a building there and come back the next day and see it's gone. And then to your point, why haven't we done this before?
I don't know.
Why is it taking so long to get this thing done? And when we first built that little section, it was going to be the great thing to get us from the east side to the freeway. And it was supposed to be something that we could get done pretty quickly. And I realize there's state issues involved in that and even some federal issues, but we ought to be able to get that done. I don't want to compliment Phoenix. I'm actually criticizing them, but I would say if that road was in Phoenix, they'd have gotten it done, and they would have worked 24 hours a day to get it done and have the least impact on. And we sometimes, our ADOT and other people sometimes take a little bit more time than they need to. Ina Road is a good example of that. 2 years to get that interchange finished, and what that was tough on those businesses.
And Houghton Road's another one that's taken forever and
right.
Still isn't done.
Yeah,
the one thing in Phoenix, they bulldozed City Hall to get it done.
Right, exactly.
Sorry, well,
and they work 24 hours a day, and the lights are on in the middle of the night, and you know, the machines don't sit lined
just
up one in a row. Yeah,
just gets done.
Get it done.
Well, Ed Ackerley, thank you so much for running. Thanks for being on our show. We'll look forward to another conversation really soon. We're a better community because you decided to get in this race. It's an uphill battle. But you said to the people that support you, I'm going to win this.
Yeah, I think I have a good shot at it. I think that's an interesting time in our democracy and in the political life of Tucson that an independent might actually be able to win this thing. I have a good feeling about it. I'm feeling positive about it. We got one more weekend of collecting some signatures. We're going to try and get to 5,000 before the weekend is through. So if anybody wants to help, jump on our website and jump on in.
Ed Ackerley, thanks for being with us.
Thank you,
appreciate
sir.
It. We'll be back in just a moment with Benny White. We'll talk about the fate of the 737 MAX. That's after these messages. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the John C. Scott Political Forum. Now, 31 years running. The longest, local talk show in all of Arizona. Glad you could join us. With us next is Benny White, who has flown for Delta Airlines passenger jets all over the world for 3 decades. He is one of the most respected airline safety experts in the country. He was a fighter pilot in the Marine Corps in Vietnam. He's our friend and has followed along these two terrible accidents of the Boeing 737s in Ethiopia and Indonesia. And he writes, it's interesting that all these articles that you've been reading mention one critical element, the pilots failed to control the aircraft. In the Ethiopian accident, the pilots left the power at full takeoff. That caused the aircraft to accelerate to 150 k's above the BMO, and the excessive speed increased the air loads on the stabilizer and the elevator such that they would not be able to manually trim the stabilizer and have any kind of effective use of an elevator that could have got the nose back up rather than into the earth. Benny White is with us now. Benny, welcome, and thanks for being with us. We appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome, John. I just have to correct you. Expert in all over the country, as long as we define all over the country as about 2 or 3 square blocks around my house.
Okay, fine, we'll take that. All right, very quickly, as we take a look at the latest in Congress and the FAA, where are we in trying to get the Boeing 737 MAX back in the air?
Well, I think we're getting closer. the administrator of the FAA, Mr. Elwell, and the director of the Flight Standards Board testified before the House on a committee on Wednesday, and they were being asked questions about the certification of the aircraft, and they discussed a little bit a meeting that's coming up next week on the 23rd, which is, I believe, Thursday of next week. And at that meeting, which will be held in Dallas, hosted by the FAA, the intention is to get the operators of the 737 MAX from all over the world, or as many of them as can, to attend that meeting. And there will be the airline executives and the pilot groups, and the certification authorities from the various countries will all be attending that. So there'll be a room full of people, I'm sure. And what they're going to talk about at that meeting is what the Boeing folks are going to propose as the fix, including the changes that they're going to make via the software to the MCAS system that we've been talking about for a couple of months, some of the displays, and then some of the recommendations for training. The FAA then will also talk about their guidelines that they're going to promulgate for training and inspection of the aircraft. And then hopefully, according to Mr. Elwell, they will be able to gather some sort of a consensus by all of the operators of the airplane that it's time to get the fix installed in the airplane, do all the necessary instructions, train the pilots, and get them back in the air.
Well, you talk about you don't expect and you don't need to have every commercial airline pilot be a qualified test pilot, but you need the manufacturers to build airplanes that can be safely operated by the average pilot, however you want to define that. Why don't you define that for me about the average pilot? Because we were comparing whether the Ethiopian pilots as well as the Indonesian pilots were anything on the same par with pilots in this country, or even in Europe for that matter. So talk about the qualification of these pilots, and then, and of course, and the two terrible tragedies that occurred.
Well, John, I don't want to cast any aspersions on either the Ethiopian pilots or the Indonesian pilots, other than to say that everyone needs to realize that we have a long history of aviation in the United States, and Europe has that same history of aviation involvement, and that's driven in large part because of the wars that we've been involved in. World War One kind of started us off in flying airplanes, and then World War Two greatly expanded that. And since that time, we've had Vietnam and now the wars in the Middle East. And all of those things generate pilots. And so we've had a long history of pilot production, if you will, that have come out of those wars. And our aviation industry then has taken advantage of those pilots to be able to fly ever increasingly large airplanes and larger airlines. And so the United States and the European operators have a long history and a long tradition, and along with that, we have a very long history of certification aircraft to make sure that they're safe to fly. And now, having said that, you know, I was involved in Delta Airlines in the training of pilots at Delta Airlines in the certification aircraft operated by Delta Airlines. And so I and my contemporaries, and I'm sure the people that followed me, are deeply involved in understanding the airplane when it comes onto the property. When you first buy the airplane from the manufacturer, I got wiring diagrams for the airplane and figured out, why does that light come on? And if it comes on, where's the switch to turn it off? And what effect does that have throughout the whole airplane? So you wind up, I've told people several times that I think probably during the certification airplanes that I was involved in, I tore apart the airplane two or three times and put it back together. And that's, I think, pretty routine in the American operators of airplanes. That was certainly my experience as a training committee chairman for the Airline Pilots Association Union when I would work with pilots from American Airlines or Southwest or FedEx or New United, anywhere else. I got the same impression that all of those folks were on a par of looking at that level of detail the functions of the airplanes, and then all of that gets reflected in the training of the pilots and the procedures that they follow. What is it that we can expect them to know based on either their military training or their civilian training? And then what other airplanes have they flown? Is this like the other airplanes, or is it different than the other airplanes? And all of that gets involved in building the simulators that the pilots are going to use for training, the writing of the manuals, how do you describe the systems, all the rest of those kinds of things get rolled into one big package.
All right, very quickly.
The foreign carriers just don't have that experience.
We in America seemingly are very willing to oversimplify everything by assessing blame. Who's to blame for this crash of the Ethiopian flight? Who's to blame for this Indonesian flight? Is it pilot error because these pilots were not as qualified as pilots in Europe and in America? Who are we going to blame when this is all said and done, do you think?
Everybody that touched the 737, I suspect, by the end of it. The manufacturer has some design problems. They've got some internal organizational problems that they're going to have to deal with. The FAA is certifying the airplane and all the parts that went in it and the manuals that describe it and the simulators used for training. All of that has to get done. And then the airline operators, when they buy a piece of equipment or an airplane, they've got to know how it operates. They've got to train their pilots, and the pilots have to be trained properly. They've got to know what they're doing. And then once the airplane gets in the air, they've got to be able to operate it and control it. When it gets out of control, they need to know how to get it back into control.
Paul's a caller to our show. Paul, you're with Benny White, our aviation expert. We'll call him that. Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, I've done quite a bit of aviation myself. I know you could tell us about the simulators. If you've got all this time in the airplane, what happened in the simulator when you started changing power and trim? And could you tell us this also? Wouldn't it be a fact that Boeing has tried to put new engines and new power settings into a 50-year-old airframe, and therefore they had to change all the weights on it, and they failed to do that? And I would like you to answer those questions, please.
Thanks, Paul. Go ahead, Betty.
Well, the last part of your question has to do with weight and balance calculations and the various considerations they make because the design change, that engines were bigger, they are larger, they do produce more thrust. All of those things are taken into the performance calculations that the company uses, and then they go out and fly the airplane. I think Boeing reported the other day in the meetings that they have something on the order of 300 test flights on the MAX type of airplane. Yes, the 737 is an old model of airplane, and possibly the 737 MAX was an extension just a bit too far. I've commented a few times about my opinion that it might have been better off to redesign the 757, put those bigger engines on it, update that airplane as necessary, and then launch that instead of a 737 MAX. But the operators of the 737 fleets, including Southwest and American and other operators around the world, wanted a bigger, more powerful, more fuel-efficient 737 so that they could reduce their pilot training costs. So it's a give-and-take game. A lot of operators only want to operate one particular type of airplane so that they can lower their simulator costs and their training costs and their maintenance costs, everything else. And that's why the 737 MAX was built the way it was built.
Very quickly, when do you expect the 737 MAX to get back in the air, if at all?
John, if they can come to an agreement next week, I would imagine that they can complete the remaining FAA certification test flights and get the software installed, get the airplanes inspected so that they're ready to go fly. And they should be able to get them back in the air in a month if they can get the pilots trained. That might stretch it out another month, but I would imagine by the end of July, the first part of August, we should see 737 MAXs back in the air.
And you have to rebuild the confidence of the American passenger in that aircraft to make this a success, if it's ever going to be one again.
Well, we do, John, and I think that'll come pretty quickly. I don't know that most passengers, when they get on an airplane, understand what model of 737 they're on, or even if it's 737. I remember when I first moved to Tucson, I used to have people tell me all the time about the 747 that they flew into in and out of Tucson, and that never happened. So I'm not sure of how acutely aware the traveling public is of what particular type of airplane they are, but they want them all to be safe, and they will be safe.
Betty White, thanks so much. I really, truly appreciate you being on our show today. It's really remarkable, the insights you give us, and I'm so pleased that you decided to join us today. Thank you very, very much.
Oh, you're welcome, John.
All right. Betty White, a longtime pilot for Delta Airline, has investigated airline crashes all over the world and has been our expert when it comes to talking about the 737. Thank you so much, Betty White. Well, we're going to be talking with Julia Sherman, Dr. Julia Sherman, in our next segment. She is a Ph.D. in clinical psychology, certified by the American Board of Examiners in professional psychology, and on top of that, a fellow of both the American Psychological Association and Association of Psychological Science. My question to her, when we begin our interview after the top of the hour, in your opinion, why do you think the Justice Department should consider invoking the 25th Amendment? That President Trump is unfit, and do you think he is mentally ill? Well, Dr. Sherman will be with us to answer that question and talk about her recent book. That's all coming up on the John C. Scott Talk Show in the second hour. I want to thank Don Jorgensen, the former chair of the Democratic Party, for being with us. Ed Ackerley, who is an independent candidate for mayor, was my guest. Benny White with Delta Airlines for over 30 years. And an observer of what's going on with the Boeing 737 in our first hour. And then coming up, Larry Bodine of Blog for Arizona brings a special guest to our studio. Dr. Julian Sherman is with us, and she'll be asked the question, is Donald Trump mentally fit to be president of the United States? And then one of our regular guests, Jeff Rogers, former chair of the Democratic Party, has a lot to say about a possible war with Iran. And the drums that are beating so loudly for war coming from the administration. Are they drowning out those who would keep us out of a conflict that could be catastrophic? That all comes up in hour number two of the John C. Scott Political Forum. Now in our 31st year of continuous political talk, this is the John C. Scott Show from KVOI, The Voice, trusted local news and talk.